From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. As the heads of state from around the world prepare for the general debate at the United Nations, which begins in New York in the coming days, we continue our coverage of issues before the UN, some of which are likely to figure prominently in that conversation. One head of state who was recently restored to that position after snap elections this past weekend is Greece's Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras. His Syriza party's victory in this past weekend's elections has apparently blocked the effort by the powers that be on the international stage to stop out the rise of an independent leftist challenge to neoliberalism in Europe. With the renegotiation of Greece's debt having been completed by the government of Tsipras this past summer, and public support for Syriza's actions as a government from this past year's January elections down to this summer's signing of the deal with the Eurozone creditors having been demonstrated this weekend, Syriza now stands ready to deal with Europe from a position of strength, with the likelihood of a Podemos victory in Spain and the possibility of contagion of the challenge to neoliberalism and austerity elsewhere across the continent, including even the UK, where the recent rise of Jeremy Corbyn as Labour Party leader signals a sea change in the political environment there. For more on this, we spoke with former Syriza member of the European Parliament, George Katrougalos, via Skype from Athens Tuesday. George, thank you for joining us. A big victory for Syriza this week, again.
Well, yes. I was expecting a victory, exactly because nobody in Greece wants to go back to the old political establishment. But it was practically more than a victory. It was a triumph.
Yeah, one of the things, it seemed to me when Syriza was elected back in January, and they spoke openly of it up in Berlin and in Brussels, was that they wanted to place Syriza as basically a parenthesis in the history of government there. Well, it seems that's an open parenthetical statement at this point. What do you guys have planned next?
Well, we have proven that we can be a force of resistance, and now we must prove that we can be also a force of reforms, and of course not of the reforms of the kind of the neoliberal restructuring, of reforms with a socially sensible and with the logic of the left. And this is not easy, exactly because we have the framework of the new memorandum, which is milder than the two others, but still, basically, a neoliberal program. So what we are trying to do is first to propose equivalent alternative measures to the ones already existing in the memorandum. The other, trying to exploit or even create a new balance of power in Europe. The idea is to discuss about the implementation of the measures, not in on a bilateral basis between us and the debtors, but asking the European Parliament to be a kind of arbiter to that. And this not because we have an ideal balance of forces even in the European Parliament, but we want to have the whole dialogue transparent, and so that all the issues that we're discussing are not typically Greek. They concern everybody in Europe.
One of the things that I hear some, I hate to use the term referring to people in the West, honestly, but the people on the left here, one of their concerns is that, first of all, that Syriza, when it came into government, was looking to solve the Greek people's problems using essentially Keynesian economics, putting some fuel at the bottom, which is the antithesis. It's antithetical to the neoliberal model within the construct of capitalism. But they seem to think that somehow you could set up a People's Republic of Greece and that would catch fire across Europe. Now, of course, the analog to that is that doing what you folks are doing and trying to assert the interests of the Greek people into the and the larger European working class into the discussions that take place in the real world now. You survived till obviously Podemos may come to power in Spain, and then the effect of all of that has not been blunted, but rather that can catch fire. Your European Parliament then looks different, doesn't it?
Well, no, it goes, we try to influence the balance of power in Europe in whatever way we can. First, obviously, if we have a victory of Podemos, even within an alliance with the Social Democrats in Spain, that would be a great boost. But just imagine that the election, for instance, of Jeremy Corbyn in the UK is reflecting a general shift of the mood within the European social democracy. Till recently, one could not find essential differences between leaders such as Blair or even Hollande and Mrs. Merkel, exactly because during these 6 months we gave the example, the paradigm of a possible alternative, even if we are not very successful in forging an agreement as we wanted it. Still, our 6 months was the sign that there is not just one policy, one way in Europe. And I think that had repercussions not only in countries where we hope to have a positive electoral outcome, like in Spain, but even in other countries, even core countries like the UK.
Yeah, I'm thinking back to the day that Yanis Varoufakis essentially was providing an economics lecture to the people in Berlin and Brussels, and that played out in the French media. So, you know, the French people saw this presented and then rejected by the European, governing councils. And, there's an awful lot of support for that position on the ground already. Hollande is nominally a socialist. There's a socialist constituency and even a communist constituency in France. And when you provide an alternative, that has to have some benefit.
Well, just because you mentioned Varoufakis, one of the very good outcomes of all these, episodes of the last 7 months is that we have created in Europe a kind of common European public space. Everybody that Varoufakis or Schäuble was giving an interview, they have been translated, not only in Germany and in Greece, but practically throughout Europe. So for the first time, instead of having many parallel national monologues around the same issue, austerity, democracy, we had practically a unified dialogue that was trespassing the national borders. That's why the European Parliament is useful, in order to keep this kind of European public space alive, not in order to have a vote and win it. Very probably you are going to lose a vote at the European Parliament. But it is very important, the average European citizen, to have an understanding that there are some common issues in Europe, democracy, austerity, and it is not easy to have a national solution to these issues. We have learned in the bitter way that it is not easy to have a social Greece in a neoliberal Europe. So we are trying to do both things simultaneously, to try to change as far as we can the Greek political and the social system and influence the more general long-term political dynamics in Europe.
You know, looking at the example of Hugo Chavez's Venezuela, for example, and the integration process there, or essentially a reintegration process away from American colonies to sovereign states with multiple social and economic systems, but all working together to build themselves up. Do you see some parallels there for what could happen in Europe?
Well, I feel a lot of solidarity with all these efforts in Latin America, and in many ways I think that they represent a hope for the global left. But we are in a very different position. We are a member of an integrated political system like this of the European Union. So we do not have the margin of autonomous movements, not we have the possibility to forge larger alliances, exactly as the leaders, the progressive leaders in Latin America do. So I think it's very important to have an exchange of experiences and discussions a discussion with our comrades in Latin America, exactly because we have the same ideals in different political contexts, and exactly because in both sides, both in Europe and in Latin America, in my understanding, we lack yet a general theory of how do we want the socialism in the future to be. We know very well what we do not want, this neoliberal counter-revolution, but still we lack the necessary theoretical tools in order to describe exactly not only our reaction, but only our ideal society.
Okay, George, appreciate it. Thank you very much for your time.
It was a pleasure. Thank you very much, Dan.
Another item that figures prominently among the various controversies swirling around the international organization centers on the medieval monarchy known as Saudi Arabia, which appears poised to head that part of the UN Human Rights Council that appoints expert panels who investigate claims of human rights violations, that despite the kingdom's own dismal record on human rights. The council, nevertheless, is continuing its ongoing work. This past Monday, it again heard accusations that the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, or DPRK, committed what it called terrible human rights abuses, according to a presentation by such panel that included allegations of murder, slavery, forced abortion, and enforced disappearances by Pyongyang. That development came a year after a UN Commission of Inquiry report accused the DPRK of crimes against humanity. We begin with this report from Daniel Johnson about the panel's presentation Monday.
In a special panel discussion on abductions, disappearances, and detentions in the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, the UN Human Rights Council heard about the misery of tens of thousands of families whose relatives had simply disappeared. Michael Kirby is the chairman of a damning UN Commission of Inquiry probe, concluding that DPRK authorities were responsible for crimes against humanity.
Amongst the most powerful human stories were the human stories of witnesses who came in our public hearings to tell us of their suffering, of their inability to know even whether their loved ones had survived, whether they were still living, and where they were and how they were.
Human rights investigator Marzuki Darisman highlighted that murder, enslavement, forced abortion and enforced disappearances were continuing in DPRK. But he added that relations between DPRK and the Republic of Korea had evolved significantly in recent years amid calls for both countries to speed up family reunifications. Other panelists included Japanese civil society organizations. They described the plight of hundreds of Japanese citizens that are thought to have been abducted by DPRK authorities. All allegations were denied by DPRK. Daniel Johnson, United Nations, Geneva.
But the list of witnesses whose testimony formed the basis of the panel's report had at its core one witness whose claims, published in a book that is often cited as Exhibit A in the case against the DPRK, have been completely discredited by his own father and even by the book's author. Brian Becker from the Answer Coalition has traveled to the DPRK numerous times over the period from the late 1980s to the past year. He gave us his first-hand account and some factual context when we spoke with him via Skype Tuesday.
The United Nations Human Rights Commission on DPRK is a kangaroo court organized by imperialism to not only demonize and spread falsehoods about the DPRK, but to refer the leadership of the DPRK, and particularly the principal leader, Kim Jong-un, to the Hague as an international criminal case referral, meaning that the DPRK leadership has been notified by this so-called Human Rights Commission that their leadership is subject to being arrested and brought to The Hague, just as Milosevic was in Yugoslavia or other leaders were. And that can only be designed when you call someone a war criminal, refer them to an international criminal court that, of course, is a kangaroo court in itself as well. It's not a comprehensive court. Imperialist leaders are never brought to referral for the International Criminal Court, but it's designed to make it impossible to carry out negotiations of any type, any sort of normalization of relations with the DPRK, because if you have the label of war criminal or having committed crimes against humanity, then it makes it hard for any other government to negotiate with you. And the panel is such a fraud. I mean, it's such a fraud. The leader of the panel, Michael Kirby, who was a retired Australian Supreme Court judge, who is the leader in Australia of something called Australians for a Constitutional Monarchy, is joined by his second top person in the panel is Marzuki Doraisman, who was an accomplice of Suharto, the military dictator who came to power in Indonesia after a bloody coup led by the Indonesian generals along with the CIA. The coup that carried, you know, killed at least 1 million and perhaps 2 million Indonesians and snuffed out a progressive anti-imperialist government led by Sukarno in 1965. Doraisman, who's number two again in the Human Rights Commission, was first a prosecutor and a top government official with Suharto for 15 years. After Suharto was ousted and the military dictatorship was formally ended, Doraisman, the same individual, seized control of Suharto's party, the Golkar Party, and reorganized the party under his leadership. Then you have Sonia Bazurko, who was essentially a CIA operative against the Milosevic government and trying to undermine and overthrow the Yugoslav government starting in 1991 following the collapse of the Soviet Union. And these are the people who have this very political, very ideological, very right-wing orientation, and many of them, several of the top leaders, connected to the most brutal regimes and also to foreign and Western intelligence agencies. They're the ones who are conducting the human rights investigation of the DPRK, which the DPRK has condemned as completely based on falsehoods. Now, interestingly, the number one witness before the Human Rights Commission was an individual named Shin Dong-hyuk, and he was the star witness outlining all of the so-called bestial crimes committed by the government of the DPRK against its own people. He was cited by CNN, by Amnesty International, by Human Rights Watch, by 60 Minutes, by the New York Times. He was his, quote, life story of cruelty of being born in a gulag in North Korea.
A book.
Was the basis of the book Escape from Camp 14, One Man's Remarkable Journey from North Korea to Freedom in the West. He was the one who was pictured with George W. Bush at the George W. Bush Library in 2013. I mean, the Human Rights Commission that has condemned the DPRK government identified him as their number one witness. Well, it turns out that everything he said is not true.
His father says so.
His father came on North Korean television about a year ago and said that his son was lying, and that in fact his son had never been to a prison camp. It wasn't not just born in a gulag and suffered all of these horrible atrocities in this gulag/prison concentration camp in DPRK, but he had never been to prison at all. And then Shin Dong-hyuk, who had given all of these stories to the author of the book, like Blaine Harden, who wrote the book about the prison camp, One Man's Remarkable, he finally acknowledged that, quote, he purposefully falsified the main chronological and geographical aspects of his life story. So, I mean, he's the number one witness. He is the number one witness for the Human Rights Commission. But now that he's been discredited, now that he's sort of left the stage and been used up because it turned out that his whole story was a concoction, that doesn't mean that the Western media, the U.S. media, the imperialist media, doesn't continue to cite this charade called the Commission on Human Rights for the DPRK that's been organized by these individuals at the United Nations. It's treated as if it's a legitimate organization when it's nothing but a political hit squad.
You know, the imagery that people have here in the United States, as well you know, of DPRK, of North Korea, they think of it first of all as North Korea, and then they imagine barbed wire around large squared off areas with people teeming inside and being, you know, having as overlords people in military uniforms speaking with a sort of a hybrid German-Japanese accent and barking instructions at them. You spent some time there. Could you tell us what it's actually like?
Well, I've been to DPRK four times. The first time was in 1989. I accompanied an international peace delegation that was in turn accompanied by a young South Korean woman named Im Suk-young. She was 21 years old. She went to the World Youth Festival in Beijing and then took the flight from Beijing to Pyongyang. And she was probably the first South Korean who came to North Korea since the end of the Korean War, or came openly. And we marched with her from the top of Mount Baekdu, which is the northernmost part of North Korea, all the way down to the DMZ, the demilitarized zone at the 38th parallel, where South and North Korea are separated and where U.S. troops are stationed on the South Korean the South Korean side of that border. And by the way, she got to the border and she said, well, you know, I'm only 30 miles from Seoul, which is where I grew up and where I live. And you, U.S. soldiers, are blocking my path. So leave so I can come across. And when she came across, she was arrested by those soldiers and then given a 5-year sentence of hard labor as a consequence of having, quote, visited the enemy state of North Korea. So much for South Korean democracy. But that was the first time I went, and I was really surprised. I had been involved in anti-war activities and opposing U.S. occupation of South Korea with tens of thousands of troops. But, you know, I had never been to DPRK. I didn't really know what it would be like. And I was shocked to see that at that time the people were very well fed. The entire country was planted with crops. There was construction going on of new buildings in downtown Pyongyang. Even in the outskirts, in the smaller cities, there was a vibrancy to the place. Children, and you can tell a lot about society by looking at its children and seeing how they function. You can't really script and choreograph how children act. The children seemed extremely self-confident. They were walking without parental or adult supervision through the streets. They were holding hands. They were skipping. They were singing songs. The people did not look famished. They did not look like malnourished. I went again in 2001. I mean, in 2000 and 2001. And by that time, the situation had deteriorated quite a bit in DPRK. They lost most of their economic trade partners when the Soviet Union and the socialist bloc countries of Eastern and Central Europe collapsed. They no longer had access to energy resources, petroleum especially. They lost the spare parts that they needed in order to keep their factories and machinery going. Things really went downhill.
Like Cuba. The special period in Cuba.
Yeah, I mean, it was very similar. And then they had calamitous weather conditions, famines, then flooding. I mean, it was one thing after another for 4 or 5 straight years. And I think the United States really felt at that time that North Korea would fall under this severe economic contraction that they were experiencing, as the United States expected would happen with Cuba. And that in the case of Korea, that South Korea would absorb North Korea just as West Germany absorbed East Germany following the collapse of the socialist government there. But the North Koreans, like the Cubans, sort of weathered the worst of the storm. Slowly but surely, they held on. They began rebuilding. They had stabilized the economy by 2000, 2001. But it's still, you know, there was a lot of difficulty still. Because it appeared, and this is somewhat tangential but important politically for your listeners to know, that at that time the Clinton administration, which seemed to be committed to the overthrow of the DPRK government in 1994, and there was a near war between the United States and DPRK in 94 when it was the economic situation was the bleakest. By the end of the second Clinton term, Clinton and his team had decided that North Korea was not going to be overthrown. And they began the normalization of relations process. And Madeleine Albright, who was then Secretary of State, actually visited North Korea, met with Kim Jong-il, went there on the anniversary of the foundation of the Korean Workers' Party, where there was 100,000 people celebrating. It looked like there was going to be a normalization of relations. And Kim Dae-jung was the more liberal, progressive government in South Korea, was also advocating for that through what was called the Sunshine Policy. And North-South relations began to thaw as the United States policy seemed to change. But then Bush came in, and one of his first acts was to rudely sort of dismiss Kim Dae-jung, the Sunshine Policy, declare North Korea to be part of the axis of evil with Iraq and Iran. And North Korea immediately began building nuclear weapons, seeing what they could see with right. what the United States did to other spokes in the axis of evil, specifically Iraq. Which had disarmed itself and then was easily invaded. So things froze then politically between the United States and North Korea, but North Korea has continued to advance economically. And I was there in 2013 on the anniversary of the 60th anniversary of the signing of the armistice agreement that ended the Korean War between the United States and DPRK. And I have to tell you, and anyone can see this with their own eyes, especially if you've been to the country multiple times over several decades, that the economic situation had improved greatly. People were not in the same boat that they were in 2000, 2001. There was much more activity. There was a hustle and bustle. Construction was taking place. People are not obese in DPRK, certainly. There's a lot of walking instead of riding. But people looked healthy, and that wasn't just in Pyongyang. I was in throughout the country. I could see, even in the more backward and remote, economically less developed areas, there was not famine. There was no evidence of that whatsoever. And people are pretty excited about the leadership in Pyongyang. It's you have a young 30-something president, and he's introducing lots of economic and social programs. They're opening the country to a lot of tourists. 100,000 people, a lot of Europeans visited DPRK last year. By 2017, the country wants to have 1 million tourists. And they're producing their own cell phones and electronic tablets and they're not dependent on Western corporations. They're not integrated into any sort of neoliberal world economy. But they are making significant technological strides and advances that I think what most Americans, if you travel to North Korea, you would be quite shocked, because it doesn't comport to the image in the U.S. media of DPRK.
There's been an interesting shift also with respect to multipolarity in Asia, with China, on the one hand, entering into a number of very important economic agreements with with South Korea, with the Republic of Korea, with the, you know, there's a rather healthy domestic economic set of interests inside South Korea. And China, of course, offers a much larger market for its products to South Korea than the United States could hope to offer, particularly with the impoverished people of the United States. So I'm wondering, are there some hopes developing there for the DPRK in that context?
I think so. There is a sort of multipolarity and new contradictions developing, and exacerbated, I would say, primarily as a consequence of the U.S.-Asia pivot. I think that if we take a step back and look at the big picture, we can see that by 2020, the United States will have most of its high-end Air Force and naval assets in the Pacific region. More than half of the U.S. Navy and Air Force will be in the Pacific region by 2020. The Asia pivot is a dramatic militarization of the Pacific region. And And as a consequence, there will be new contradictions, new dangers, and perhaps new relationships in response to the American imperialist sort of escalation in that region.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.